I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Rebecca Kingston, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Toronto. We're discussing her recent book, Plutarch's Prism, Classical Reception and Public Humanism in France and England, 1500 to 1800, from Cambridge University Press. Kingston's research is on early modern political thought and the role of emotions in politics. She has written several books and articles on these topics. Well, first of all, Rebecca Kingston, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Well, thank you very much, Jeffrey. It's very much of a pleasure for me to participate, and thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, well, thank you for the book. I mean, it's really an impressive work of analysis, like a kind of sweeping analysis, I think, across several hundred years of late medieval, early modern thought, seeing the reception of Plutarch against a, you know, really wide variety of different thinkers. So really a book with a lot of impressive erudition. So congratulations on the book. Let me ask you just, first of all, what was the motivation for writing this book in the first place?
Well, I guess there were several things, but part of it was a sense of there was a lack of attention to things in the literature that should have been there. So I guess I was schooled as sort of an ally to many thinkers, commonly called the Cambridge School. And I always felt in reading stories of the development of early modern thought, whether it be through Pocock's work or Skinner's work or some of the literature on civic humanism and republicanism and so on, that there was something a little bit lacking in their reading of the French tradition. And in part to come to terms with that, I guess I recognized through my years of teaching and reading that Plutarch as a reference in the French tradition sort of jumps out at you, particularly in figures like Montaigne and Rousseau, people who acknowledge their incredible debt to Plutarch. And so I thought that it would be important to see not just the influence of Plutarch on those particular thinkers, but to go a little bit more deeply and to see the ways in which Plutarch resonated through the French tradition. This also coincided with a turn in scholarship to greater attention to classical reception, and the wish to think about how these sources from the classical world were used, interpreted, reinterpreted through the process of reception and to some degree translation. You know, obviously I'm not a philologist. I'm not focused so much on the technicalities and all the intricate details and knowledge and specialized knowledge that all of that requires. But I do think that some attention to that is important, just in the way that political theorists are turning to, for example, Hobbes as a translator of Thucydides, as important for understanding his thoughts. So even in political theory, there's an interest to look at these issues from the training of a political theorist to see what their import would be for the development of the history of ideas. So that was also part of the motivation to look at Plutarch as a way to think about the deeper connection or special nature of the French tradition. Of course, a canonical book in that regard is Nanga Haines' book, The Philosophy of the State in France, but that's getting a little bit dated now. There's new scholarship and so on. And again, Plutarch doesn't really come out significantly in that work either. So that was part of the initial motivation is just to address a gap, an important gap I saw in scholarship, to illuminate something that was missing in the narrative, and to think about what that could offer us in terms of how we think about the history of political thought. So.
Yeah, good. And if you're able to, you know, say something just generally about what it is that it illuminates, if we look at the French and English tradition in this way. I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, again, I mean, we typically think of the transition from antiquity to modernity, or at least a lot of scholarship focuses on Machiavelli, and the kind of, especially with the Cambridge School, the development of a kind of civic Republican tradition, Atlantic Republican tradition. And so how does, you know, an attention to Plutarch's reception in France and England, you think, sort of, you know, what does it add to the story? I think there's sort of too much focused on Machiavelli. So is there another dimension to civic republicanism, or how does it help us think about this tradition more differently?
Right. I would suggest that it's a tradition distinct from civic republicanism, right? So standard accounts of Renaissance thought for political theorists often argues that many ideas of humanism, Renaissance humanism, as related to political theory, were initially developed in Italy with regard to the small sovereign states trying to defend their autonomy against both the papal states and the Holy Roman Empire, and through that process developed a language of liberty and autonomy, or at least taking some of the elements of Renaissance humanism, developing them in a political direction, which was then exported to the Netherlands and to England and across Europe, and that was the dominant expression of Renaissance humanism in politics. And my argument is that certainly that was one important aspect of what was going on in the Renaissance, but it's not limited to that, even in terms of political theory. And it doesn't fit well, particularly in the French case, just because of the nature of the monarchy and so on. I mean, there have been theories, and James Collins has recently written a book about the monarchical commonwealth, as it's sometimes called, or republican language in monarchies. And some people try to come to terms with that, both in the English tradition and in the French tradition, with regard to how there was emphasis on trying to open up access to local governments, so that there is a greater push to participatory logic, not completely obviously, but at the local level, in which they could combine certain republican principles with monarchy. But my argument is that, yes, the language of republic, at least, or maybe not republic, that's sort of misleading, I guess, in my own interpretation, but res publica, which is translated into the French as la chose publique. But initially, at least in the early wave in which Plutarch was brought into the French tradition, into the vernacular. So again, that's an important aspect of my book, that I'm focusing on how Plutarch was brought into France in the French language. There was obviously some circulation in Latin and so on, but the important thing, particularly for politics, and why this is significant, is that rulers in France were not educated in the classical languages. So, you know, the kings, as they say, were too busy learning the art of falconry and the art of war. You know, Francis I, right, was captured on the battlefield because kings were actually involved in military campaigns. And so there was all sorts of knowledge that they needed to acquire. They didn't have the time or maybe the motivation to learn Latin and Greek well. So that What's interesting in the French case is that these texts of Plutarch were initially brought into France via mechanisms of not from Italy at all, but rather through Byzantine émigrés who would sometimes translate these texts from Greek to Latin, or so, for example, in the case of Jean Lascaris, who was an important Byzantine émigré, translating Plutarch into Latin so that Claude de Seyssel, for example, could translate it from the Latin to the French, translating it to be read to the king, right? And so there's a number of these texts. Boudet was also, who was much more at home in Latin and Greek and didn't really, his French was a bit rusty actually, but he would write in French as a way to make a case directly to the king about partly flattering the king, but partly suggesting that the king needs to pay attention to funding patronage for education and the humanities and so on. And so Boudet's Institution du Prince is his one of the few works he actually wrote in French, again, because it was written to be read to the king as advocacy for some of the things that Boudet thought were very important. I mean, Boudet was influential in the founding of the Collège de France, for example. So the point is that the vernacular is important in France, particularly in France, but we know in terms of England, Henry VIII actually was very well versed in classical languages. But in the case of France, the kings needed the vernacular to as a way of conversing and learning about politics. And so those particular thinkers in France who took it upon themselves to take Plutarch and translate, or at least, I mean, these translations were not often in the initial stages a verbatim account of Plutarch's work, but someone like Boudet would take excerpts from Plutarch, and his Institution du Prince was taking passages from Plutarch and with insertions of arguments about what Boudet was seeking from the king. Seyssel was taking parts of Plutarch to complement other translations. And so it was interesting in that it was not a civic humanist or civic republican argument, but the way in which, in both these translations of Seyssel and Boudet, but also in more generalized, I guess, initiatives in which Plutarch was brought into the French tradition. I place a lot of emphasis on the 1532 translation of Plutarch's essay on politics, sometimes called Precepts of Statecraft, and or Political Precepts. It's translated in different ways in the English. And here, there's a interesting way in which the term la chose publique is understood and used in the text, although translated from the Latin, right, as res publica, the way that it's a complicated story. I don't need to go into all the details, but basically, where in the Greek there are terms that are used to invoke public affairs or affairs that are in common to the community through the Latin, and then the French is invoked as la chose publique. So there's a sort of reification of not just the whole state, right, but of the public sphere. And so the way that the term is used in that translation is used in contrast to private affairs, and used in contrast to the private sphere. So it's almost like it comes much closer to our understanding of the term, the public sphere. And when read through that language, that particular translation then provides an ethos of helping us understand that the public sphere is regulated by a very particular and interesting set of norms that are distinct from those of the private sphere. So whereas, and while Plutarch is obviously an author who's very concerned about character and moral growth and so on, but there are particular requirements of that ethos in a public position that are and can be seen as somewhat distinct from someone in a private position. So Plutarch, in that particular essay, which among Plutarch scholars has always been seen as something that is much more pragmatic than his usual discourse, talks about the special rules of visibility, for example, that someone in a public position has to think about, sort of as being on stage, being in a theatrical performance. And also in that particular writing, Plutarch talks about the ways in which the rules of friendship apply differently when one is in a public position versus when one is in a private position, right? You can't acquiesce to all of your, you can't develop your friendships and give them the same benefits in the same way in a public position as you can in a private position. And there's some ways in which by wanting to bring the people along with you, there are ways in which you may need to present issues as a way to develop things or to enhance the public welfare, the public good. But there's also a sense in which the demands of public life and the activities of public life are given a very important ethical priority. And here I try to make a distinction at the beginning of the book, because there are many who talk about, when you talk about the classical sources in Renaissance theory, many people will tell you, well, of course, Cicero is the preeminent classical person of influence. And there are many thinkers who have followed along this line. And yes, I argue that, yes, of course, Cicero has a very important influence. But that in the French tradition, there's an argument to be made that Plutarch is even more influential, partly because the way in which Plutarch was brought into the tradition was often through political theorists who both translated aspects of Plutarch and went on to write political treatises. Plutarch, and partly related to the fact that, you know, kings were not well versed in the classical languages, part of the appeal of Plutarch was that he offered particular examples, historical examples, a slightly more pragmatic, practical way to talk about politics through the ways in which historical figures had dealt with certain situations in their position of eminence. And in that particular essay that I was talking about, Les Politiques, translated by Torrey in 1532, there's strong emphasis on the importance of politics as an extension of human nature, right? So there's a lot of political thinking that suggests that there's a important division between either philosophy and politics or politics and everyday life. And it often can lead in certain ways to a sort of vilification of the act of political activity. And so Plutarch offers us a justification and a defense of politics as an activity that is centrally important to human welfare. And Plutarch himself in that essay gives a very interesting example of himself. He did in his own life have, by the end of his life, have certain consular status. He had some honorific roles within the community, but there's an account of him helping to build roads or dealing with some fairly mundane activity, which involved manual labor. And the point in the essay in describing this was that by doing this for the public, it was imbued with a much more strong ethical ethos and sense of purpose than it might otherwise have had, precisely because it was tethered to this notion of doing it for the public good. Sorry, that's a very long-winded way.
No, that's good. That's good. I mean, if I were to summarize massively and distorted, I mean, it sounds to me like what, you know, the French have a tradition of strong monarchy and maybe a worry about the arbitrary will then of a single leader. And so somebody like Plutarch, I think who develops, you know, whose parallel lives talk about individual leaders who wield power, but they wield that power ethically and in a kind of exemplary way, would be very, I think, appealing to political theorists in France as a way to guide and restrict the arbitrary will of the monarch. Is that
yes.
Right? Or okay, yeah.
Yes, I mean, there are different ways in which this was done, right? So, and what's interesting is also sort of the play of examples that different theorists would choose, and that would have an impact on the particular message that they were putting forward. So someone like Boudet had a very sort of grandiose vision, right, of political rule. And so, and maybe it was part of his intention in flattering the king through this particular piece, the Institution du Prince, but he would glorify, there's a particular story, very famous story in Plutarch's account of Alexander as a young boy, when he was asked to compete by his father, Philip, this is Alexander the Great, at the Olympic Games. He must have been, right, a young teenager or something. And Alexander said, no, you know, I can only compete if there are kings, if I'm competing against kings, as if, you know, anyone else of lower status wasn't worth himself to be tested against. And so it was a type of remark that is very characteristic of Plutarch. Plutarch tells us that he doesn't want to celebrate the exploits and the actions of his subjects, which is why he's often not seen as a historian's historian, but he wants to reveal their inner character through emphasis on the quieter moments of their lives, right? So this sort of offhand remark by a teenager is the type of thing that Plutarch latches onto, right, to demonstrate the incredible, extraordinary ambition that Alexander had at a very young age. So different theorists then interpret maybe this very same remark in different ways. So someone like Boudet will take this and run with it, with the general spin that, you know, rulers in a position of preeminence need to think of themselves in this way, that this high sense of glory and ambition is suitable, in fact, is proper for a ruler, though Boudet also tries to tame a little bit of that through the invocation of Christian principles and through perhaps a less of a celebration of conquest. Whereas you take the same remark in Plutarch through the words of someone like Erasmus, who was integrated into the French tradition in a slightly different way. But Erasmus is very much someone who cautions against, uses this remark of Plutarch to sort of demonstrate the excessive ambition of someone like Alexander, that you should not go the direction of Boudet and think of yourself in a political position in this elevated way, but rather use this as a word of caution, because Alexander did not end well.
I was going to say, I mean, you could talk about, you know, some of other Plutarch's other examples too, because I mean, you talk in the first chapter, you sort of introduce for those of us a little primer on Plutarch, and summarize some of the main sections. But you know, so I mean, in addition to some, you know, the Julius Caesar and Alexander's, there's also founding legislators figures like Numa and Lycurgus are paired against one another. Maybe you could say a little bit about how the French tradition takes up some of these different figures and how they disagree or emphasize in different ways some of the different figures in Plutarch, who presents a variety of different kind of models that later thinkers could take up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and what's interesting about how they're taken up as well is that whereas in Plutarch, he often offers the exposition of one figure. Obviously, it's a Greek figure placed in parallel with a Roman figure. And then in a certain number of these, he offers a comparison of the two, where he comes to a more succinct judgment of how to think about the juxtaposition of the two. So what is interesting is often in the tradition of perception, the parallelism gets dropped. So you have these thinkers, Boudet or whoever, who will take one and run with them, or take the remarks about one figure out of context. Not only that, but often they will reverse the judgment. It's often the case that Plutarch will be more supportive of the Greek figure, although there are exceptions to that. And one important exception to that is his preference for the humaneness and moderation of Numa over Lycurgus, for example. And there, of course, is a champion of the Roman figure over the Greek. But what often happens is that figures in the history of political thought will take the figure who is championed less by Plutarch and use them as their champion.
Yeah, that's great. So maybe you can say a little bit about Montaigne as a figure in this tradition. I mean, because, you know, one, I think, way to think about Montaigne and maybe the French tradition in general, which I think you're trying to critique, and as far as I understand what you're doing, is, you know, I mean, Montaigne in some interpretations presents a kind of figure who represents or suggests a kind of withdrawal from politics, and the emphasis on private life. But Plutarch plays an important role in his thought, as you show. So, you know, so how does Plutarch's influence in Montaigne help us rethink Montaigne and then rethink this kind of more, you could say, sort of anti-political understanding of the French period?
Right. Yeah. So I guess this also goes back to one of the questions you asked me in terms of the, partly motivation, but another. So if we were to think about how early modern thought has a linear relationship to our contemporary political discourse, you'd say that the language of civic republicanism, right, relates to concerns about liberty and participatory politics to some degree. You know, there's discussions about whether that tradition is more aristocratic than democratic, but questions about the nature of politics and deliberation in politics. Another way in which the ancient tradition is thought to have an impact on contemporary politics is through lines of Hellenistic thinking. And what I mean by the term Hellenism is particularly those schools of Stoicism, Skepticism, and Epicureanism. And, you know, there's a huge amount of literature, you know, Stephen Greenblatt, right, talking about the introduction of Epicureanism as an influence on the modern ethos and so on. And of course, there's interesting and good books about Stoicism working in through Kant and so on and into the modern mindset. But the one thing that is, of concern to me, right, is that despite ways in which some of these traditions have been seen in revisionist thinking as having certain impact on political thought, so, you know, Stoics were not necessarily adverse to participation, for example, and there's some documents found at Herculaneum that suggest that even Epicureans had a sort of political theory. But the general thrust of Hellenism as a set of ideas is that it's about centered on the order, internal ordering of the individual soul and the search for peace or apatheia, right? The search for inner calm. And so even though there's some discussion about ways in which these schools of thought may have had implications for political life, the bottom line, as I see it, is ultimately when push comes to shove, things external to the individual that they can't control have to be seen as indifferent, right? Have to be seen as morally indifferent because they are things over which the individual will cannot have influence or control, right? And so there's an implication in these. There's a sort of devaluation of the political because ultimately it's a realm of fortuna, right? Rather than virtue. Virtue is over, is a question of internal ordering. And so that's a real challenge. And I've taught Montaigne for several years in seminars. And so the question, of course, is that Montaigne, by interpreters, has always been seen as someone who was very much rooted in Hellenistic schools. You know, there's the standard interpretation of Montaigne that he started in sort of somewhat of a possibly Stoic view, moved to a skeptical vision of the world, right? The Apology of Raymond Sebon, and then eventually near the end of his life and the latter revisions to the essays took more of an Epicurean stance. But Plutarch in his writings was very critical of Hellenism, was very critical of these schools precisely because of their devaluing of the political. So the question is, how can Montaigne, I mean, obviously these things are complicated and how they diffuse themselves in intellectual history, but how does Montaigne himself see both his devotion to Plutarch, which in the select phrases of the essays, right, is you know, my man is, it's a very personal relationship, and obviously, you know, he talks poetically about his attachment to the work of Plutarch, and in fact, the essays themselves are modeled The essay itself is modeled on the moral essays that Plutarch himself wrote. So there's a deep attachment to the ideals of and the work of Plutarch, along with, so how does this square with also the influence of these Hellenistic schools? And my reading, or my way of trying to make sense of this, is to suggest that, I mean, there are readings who, of Montaigne, more recent readings, Thompson, for example, who argues, and Dessant, Philippe Dessant, who just wrote an important biography of Montaigne, who suggests that in the essays, Montaigne sort of underplays his own political engagements as mayor and so on, and that part of the strategy of the essays is a way to either to show his sort of place himself outside of politics, to show his ability to talk about these things from the outside as a way to, in fact, promote himself as someone who is suitable, who's of neither one party nor the other, who can adjudicate these things sort of from an external view and thus is suitable for promotion within the royal administration. So that it's a sort of, well, as I suggest, a sort of, you know, in another sort of way, a Machiavelli, you know, the way we talk about the prince, as it was written by Machiavelli, is a way to get, well, this is sort of Montaigne's way of doing the same thing. That's sort of the bottom line of that interpretation. But I don't take that view. The view that I take, and in the book, I only look very closely at a few essays where political life is discussed, where Montaigne recognizes the dominant, and in the context of religious struggles, you know, some of the ugly things that are going on in the political life of his own day, which of course we can, you know, in some ways reading Montaigne now, we can see some of the parallels there in terms of certain personalities and people who seem terribly corrupt and whose motivations seem all wrong for going into public life. And my reading of that is that Montaigne is not disavowing public life. He tells us in some very key passages that everyone is implicated in the corruption of their times, that you can't disassociate yourself from the public sphere, and that all people have a responsibility to try to raise the tone and to raise the possibilities for civility and humaneness in their own era. So at some level, it's an attempt to sort of widen the responsibilities for the political, that politics isn't just what we would see as the narrow responsibility of politicians, but there is a sense in which we all have to try to contribute to the raising of the bar in the times of our era. Montaigne recognizes the difficulties in politics, the moral tensions, and but I think he does offer some elements of hope, right? That that with sort of concerted and even piecemeal efforts, you don't have to get swept away in the vice and corruption of the era. And right, that you can have an influence in seeking to shift that. Yeah.
And I was thinking about this in an institutional way, right? In the French tradition, there's the, it's a strong monarchical tradition, but there's also the institution of the Parlement and aristocratic tradition, that is. And, I was wondering if you could say a little bit about, you know, the role of the Parlement here in the French tradition, because I'm assuming the role of Plutarch in these French thinkers, it's not simply, you know, hortatory for the central monarch, improve thyself and attend to the public things, right? But it's also it has broader implications for, not full participatory, political involvement, but at least in an institution like the Parlement, this would have some resonance too, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the Parlement were often more judicial institutions than legislative institutions. I mean, their role was to register the edicts that were put forward by the king to make sure they were of legal force in their jurisdiction. And then they would be the top court of appeal for the various court mechanisms, seigneurial, and so on, seneschals and lower royal courts in the district. But yes, and that's sort of part of the argument that through the initially, right, the translations were done in French for the king and the court, and not and were in manuscript form, and only later were they published. And so there's a sort of diffusion, a broader, as in parallel in some ways, as diffusion became more extensive through books in the vernacular, and obviously technologies were also developing and language was developing, Amio in his important translations of Plutarch's Lives and Moralia in 1559, when the Lives came out, is said to have transformed the French language to make it much more poetic in bringing it closer to certain Greek constructions and so on. So there's an eloquence also associated with the introduction of Plutarch in France. And this all made then the work of Plutarch more accessible. And at the same time, the substance of some of the arguments in the reception and appropriation of Plutarch, such as through Montaigne, becomes a message that is accessible and applicable to many more interested in public affairs beyond the king and their court.
We've been talking a lot about France. Can I take you across the channel, as it were? you talk about England too in the book, and you me. I mean, there are so many figures here that we could talk about. I mean, some of the high points you talk about: Thomas More, the reception of Plutarch, and More's Utopia. Talk about Shakespeare. I'd love to talk about Shakespeare. Talk about Hobbes. I mean, maybe we could go to Shakespeare, but if there's anything that you want to say to kind of set the stage and how the sort of English tradition has similarities to or differs from the French tradition in receiving Plutarch.
Right. So part of the argument, just to make a long story short, I brought in the English tradition as a point of contrast to the French, but also because of the general idea that civic humanism flourished in England. And this is a way also to sort of think about Plutarchan traditions in England in distinct from civic republicanism. But the general idea is that Plutarch played initially less of a role in English political thought in the Renaissance than it did in France. The Plutarch was generally regarded more as a strictly moralist, I guess, not in the French 17th century sense, but as someone who was arguing for a classical Platonic understanding of virtue and so on. And that while there were some translations of Plutarch's work, those translations were not deemed in the English tradition as canonical for political reflection per se. Although interesting cases, right? Elizabeth I translated Plutarch several years before her death, an essay on curiosity, which in some ways could be seen as a reflection of her own preoccupations with the difference between her private self and public self. Really quite interesting. Of course, the important shift in the English case, as I argue, was In fact, the translation of Plutarch by, of all of Plutarch's works, extant works by Amio, The Lives in 1559, The Moralia in 1572, this was taken up quite quickly by Thomas Norris, who translated The Lives from Amio's French to the English. And of course, Shakespeare uses North as a basis for writing most of his Roman plays, right? The first Roman play was Titus Andronicus, was his first sort of attempt to write about Roman history in a sort of phantasmagoric.
Pretty wild stuff, yes.
of Roman history. And so what Shakespeare draws on in Plutarch is, of course, more of the dramatic aspects of character and dilemmas which is why Plutarch has been, his lives in particular, have been so popular through history, is there is this sort of dramatic feel to his work, to his writing, and Shakespeare certainly picked up on that. But giving it, my interest in looking at Shakespeare, which I compare to the French, again, taking up of these themes in Plutarch through Racine's Mithridate and Corneille's La Mort de Pompée, is how the political themes were treated in drama. I don't claim to be a Shakespearean expert but I think it's interesting to look at how these political themes played out in these plays and how Shakespeare sort of picked up partly on Montaigne's concern about the viciousness of politics, but nonetheless, I think arguably both in Shakespeare as well as in these French dramatists, you still find a salutary message with regard to political engagement and public life, despite, right?
Yeah. Right, right. There is it picks up on the nobility of political activity from the ancients and in the plays, Anthony Cleopatra, Julius Caesar, but the dilemmas that accompany them too, right?
Mm-hmm,
struggle that an exemplary character has to face in the sort of tragic entailment that occurs within
mm-hmm,
it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense that how Shakespeare, because I don't know the Plutarch well enough, I guess I would know Shakespeare better, but does he alter the Plutarch stories in significant ways that you see, or is it a pretty faithful summary of the Plutarch?
No, he does in certain ways. I mean, obviously there are scholars who go through this with a fine-tooth comb. Probably one of the most obvious examples is that for Plutarch, Anthony, the story of Anthony is a story of what Plutarch scholars would call it a deterrent story. In other words, it's seen as the fall of someone who had great potential, and it's not a story of the tensions between love and politics, right? It's the for Plutarch, Anthony's attraction to Cleopatra was seen as a sort of a character deficiency that led him away from proper action, and the symbolic moment of that is in the middle of the Battle of Actium, where Anthony could have had the upper hand and was facing Octavian's fleet. Cleopatra makes a quick getaway in her own boat, and Anthony abandons the battle to follow her, and that's sort of the moment when Antony's commitments become clear, and his, for Plutarch, his moral deficiencies become clearly apparent. But obviously, you know, as a young as a young girl, you know, in the I'm going to age myself, but in the 70s, right? I'd come home after school and watch, you know, the 4 o'clock movie, and Antony and Cleopatra, you know, the Elizabeth Taylor sort of version would make a huge impact on me. And of course, the way these stories are now spun, it's all about, you know, the love story, but that was not the focus for, or certainly not the positive focus for Plutarch, you know.
Yeah. You have a chapter on Hobbes, which I thought we could talk about, which is called "Shedding New Light on Hobbes's Leviathan." Which I, yes. You know, I was great. This is not easy to shed new light on Hobbes's Leviathan, but it is quite interesting because I think you mentioned this earlier in the conversation. But typically, I think insofar as we think about classical sources for Hobbes, it's Thucydides, since Hobbes translated Thucydides, but. You know, and there's a tension to the, you know, Civil War and how that might have played into the state of nature. But, you know, Hobbes also read Plutarch. So maybe you could say a little bit about how you think Plutarch influenced Hobbes and how that helps us understand the Leviathan a little bit differently.
Right. Yeah. This is something, obviously, I didn't go into the whole project with this in mind, but some felicitous, I guess, thing that I found through some detective work. So one of the important translators of Plutarch's moral essays in the 17th century was a man called Philemon Holland. So he translated a number of essays, and one of which was an interesting work by Plutarch called How to Profit from Your Enemies. And the general account that Plutarch gives in this tale is that in a sort of pre-civilized era, individuals were fearful of fire, they were fearful of beasts, they lived in trepidation of all things in their environment. But then a sort of moral shift happened, and they began to recognize that they could use the beasts for their benefit, they could use the fire for their benefit, and on that build a more commodious form of life. And so the contrast between the first stage, as we might call it, a stage theory of human existence, was this attitudinal shift in how things that were initially thought to be hostile could be seen as useful. And this, of course, for Plutarch is a moral analogy to the perils of competition in a public setting, that the enemies, the people who you perceive as out to get you or as being hostile to you, when viewed with a different sort of attitude, could be seen as helpful for your own development in the sense of telling you things that maybe your friends might not tell you, or shedding light on your weaknesses. And that if you use that hostility for your own benefit in the sense of self-reflection and self-improvement, those sorts of circumstances can actually be good for you. So in this tale that Philemon is translating, he talks about, as a sort of summarizing of the condition before the attitudinal change, as one in which was brutish and savage. I can't remember the exact words, but it's part of the terms and part of the cadence of the phrase has a lot of similarities with Hobbes's summarizing of the state of nature as nasty, brutish, and short, right? So it made me come to the realization that there's actually a lot of parallels between Plutarch's account and Hobbes's account, in the sense that they're talking about shifts in the development of civil organization that are predicated on a shift in sort of attitudinal perception of what others and potential objects of fear and hostility can actually, if looked at in a different light, lead to different sorts of behaviors and more civil coexistence. So I develop that parallel. So not just showing that the terms of Philemon Holland's translation were taken up by Hobbes, but it also gives us insight into, I basically think about those interpretations of Hobbes that develop a minimal virtue theory. So not sort of full-blown perfectionism, but I go through, for example, Hobbes's discussion of the virtue of generosity, and suggest that there are limited virtues that Hobbes recognizes as necessary for civil order, in addition to fear of the Leviathan. So the fear of the Leviathan doesn't do all the work in preserving peace that we might initially think it does, and that there's an important role for recognizing the potential hostility of others. Right, Hobbes tells us we lock our doors. There's a sense in which there's a potential competition there for scarce resources and so on, but that recognizing the need to mitigate that hostility, because if that hostility was brought to full force and full fruition, it would lead to collective devastation. We act in a virtuous way. We seek to improve our relationship with the other, even with the sense that perhaps we are still hostile to each other, but that virtues are practiced in a limited way to improve and benefit, right, from the very hostility that lies underneath. So yeah, it's an interesting attention to, and this is, again, an important thread in the book. There are a lot of threads in the book, but the attention to social psychology and moral psychology in governance. And I suggest that through Bacon and Hobbes, this is the point where we see that important insight of Plutarch brought into the English tradition and to political reflection.
Yeah, that's great. It's more possibility for a kind of spontaneous order in Hobbes's polity, not just kind of a centralized, rationalized order, which I find interesting. There's also you discuss the role of honor, which is, you know, and plays an important role in Hobbes's Leviathan. And that there may be a kind of Plutarchian provenance to that. I often thought, you know, I mean, this is a, you know, is Plutarch someone and this sort of the exemplary noble characters that he's putting forward, somebody that maybe Hobbes is critical of, in the sense that, you know, these are the kind of figures who's striving after glory, right, are the people that are like in danger of modern polity. So is that, you know, is Hobbes the kind of person that wants us to read less Plutarch, I guess? My question.
Well, it sort of depends how you read Plutarch, right? So I obviously Amyot's translation, which presented the work of the lives of the illustrious, right? That there is a reading of Plutarch and a tradition of reading Plutarch that sees these individuals as glory-seeking and ambitious and exemplary figures, in the sense that we should try to mimic their exploits and so on. Arguably, this isn't really what Plutarch was doing in his work. So I guess this goes to the two ways in which, or I guess several ways in which exemplarity can work. Right? So another way of thinking about the book, which is in many ways not a way which people tend to think about Plutarch today. And so arguably, right, it's sort of what I feel is the decline of some of the initial readings of Plutarch, at least maybe not the Boudean reading of Plutarch, but some of the earlier readings of Plutarch, which saw his discussion of figures not so much as a way to offer examples of what one should do, right, but rather offered templates of and publicly recognizable examples of what the virtues were, right? So the discussion of, take a figure, right, Numa being humane in his dealings with the Romans was a way for Plutarch to discuss the virtue of humaneness rather than suggesting that all his readers should become Numa, right? Or discussing the courage of certain people in battle was again not to promote necessarily the same exploits, but to teach us about the nature of courage and how it plays out, or to talk about, you know, sometimes there's a discussion as to whether military virtues and political virtues can be combined, right? Some of these people who are generals don't do as well in public life. So the one way of reading the lives is that it's the selection of publicly recognizable figures to demonstrate moral precepts and both moral psychology and social psychology that can have more general application, rather than to argue for direct emulation of these individuals.
Yeah, that's helpful.
And I think we've lost that. And it may be one of the reasons why Plutarch is less read, because it's generally presumed to be a sort of hagiography of celebration of, I mean, dead white males, I guess, to be, you know, and that it represents a sort of cultural a cultural pantheon that we're trying to some degree put behind us. But I'm not so sure that was Plutarch's intent, right, in writing this.
Yeah. I mean, right. There's a kind of way to take exemplarity as a kind of hero worship on the one hand, you know, act like this person unthinkingly, but then there's the kind of exemplarity as a support or basis for moral reasoning, that it's both a kind of way to make concrete, you know, kind of abstract ethical reasoning.
Right.
Like it's one, you can read Aristotle and read about courage all day long, but unless you have a sort of exemplars of how courage actually works, it's difficult to make judgments about the kinds of things Aristotle wants you to do, when to act in a particular place at a particular time. But it's also it's also, just, you know, finish the thought. I mean, it's also a way to justify that theory can be made practical at all. I mean, that's the other interesting thing. Like sometimes you think, virtues, I mean, these are just pie in the sky ideals. Well, no, we can actually point to people who have embodied these things before.
Right. Yeah. And I know it's in the modern era, modern liberalism, there's a difficulty in thinking about how these classical ideals may apply or still apply in an age of pluralism and so on. But I would hope that one of the legacies of the book is that questions of character are not completely irrelevant in the contemporary era, right? That they're, you know, maybe virtue with a capital V is, you know, something that's more difficult to think about in contemporary eras, but there are definitely important considerations about the virtues as a whole and what they mean and how. And I think that there's been, and this is where I say there's a certain betrayal of Plutarch through the 18th century, is, you know, someone like the Abbe de Saint-Pierre thought of, tried to sort of appropriate Plutarch in a language of utility, that it's all about what's done or the effects at the end of the day. Or someone like the Abbe de Mably, who takes Plutarch as sort of a stringent moralist, a sort of language of what I call moral absolutism, which in some ways weaponizes virtue, that all these are in some ways misappropriations, and that there's a way in which a discussion of the virtues in practice, in application, with a sort of subtle discussion, and in some ways not clear. You know, Plutarch juxtaposes these lives partly because, and doesn't give us always the clear answer, because it's a sort of a picture through which we have to test our own judgment about virtues and so on. And so it's a much more variegated complex terrain than what one tends to today in popular thinking, or even in elite thinking, attached to Plutarch, right? There's a, you invoke Plutarch and people think of sort of a stringent moralism, or but if you go back to the text, it's different, you know.
Yeah, so let's close with that 18th century. I mean, you sort of started us on this with the you know, I don't know, distortions of Plutarch, or receptions that in any case sort of, I think, simplify him rather than make him living and complex, which previous thinkers did. I mean, just to focus on Rousseau, since he's such a seminal thinker. I'm especially interested in this because I think my own sense is this is how Plutarch gets into the German tradition. I've been translating Fichte here for a couple of years. Fichte, I think Plutarch is very influential on Fichte, but I think it's because it's through Rousseau that he sort of gets wind of this. In any case, that separate conversation. But on Rousseau, I mean, Plutarch plays an important role in his thought. I mean, maybe you could develop that out. How do you see it? That influence becoming manifest, and how does, you know, what's the limitation here that Rousseau has in Plutarch?
Right. So Plutarch, in many ways, is integral not only to the writing of Rousseau, but the persona of Rousseau. Right. If you believe the Confessions, where he talks about, you know, almost being fed with Plutarch with his mother's milk, right? He and his father used to read his mother's books, and he, one of the first chapters of the Confessions, he's talking about falling, you know, enamored with all the figures of the Plutarchan opus. And so through the Confessions, these themes about the fascination of these heroes and so on are woven through his life story. And I suggest that the idea of exemplarity plays an important role in Rousseauian moral development. At least you read the literature, you read his Judy and Emile and so on, and these figures, or the notion of exemplarity, as well as some of the figures from particularly the Roman tradition crop up. And education, moral education, right, is central to Plutarch's ideal. And of course, the Emile offers that. And so there's a sense in which these themes are very, very important for Rousseau. Yet I do suggest that there's a sense that we, at least that Rousseau, to a certain degree, you know, the moral education, the process of education, well, the idea of moral education he shares with Plutarch. there's also the influence of Condillac and a lot of the empiricists in Rousseau. So the process of education, how moral education is actually developed, is different. So there's this sort of appropriation of the broad framework, but in the details of its implementation, there's a radical shift, a modernization of how these things are perceived. And in terms of politics, obviously that's the central focus of the book. The suggestion is that what the Rousseauian account, particularly in the social contract, I argue, ignores or perhaps doesn't do justice to from the Plutarchan tradition, despite, and I go through a lot of the current interpretations of Rousseau, is the ultimate idea that it's a sort of repudiation of the importance of a sense of stewardship among those who govern, as well as the sense of the give and take and what we might call the messiness of politics. There's sort of an attempt by Rousseau to capture popular will in a sort of, I mean, I know there's revised interpretations that suggest there's a sort of cultivation there, and that it's not just, there's a way in which a curation of proposals put before the people and so on, and that the people aren't quite as sovereign as you might think they are and so on. Nonetheless, right, the idea is, in push comes to shove, the idea is that a snapshot of the popular will in one instance is the defining moment of both sovereignty, authenticity, and liberty, right? All of that, all of the strong ideals of Rousseauian democracy or Rousseauian governance comes through this moment when the people say yay or nay, right? And my argument is that in earlier understandings of Plutarch, there is more room for a give and take, for a discussion, for popular education, for politics as a process of discussion, rather than suggesting a momentary understanding of what the will is, and that being the last word.
Yeah, that seems to make sense. I mean, the sort of democratizing character of Rousseau's thought seems to it rubs up in a difficult way with I guess you could just say the sort of aristocratic tradition of Plutarch. I mean, you could imagine ways in which Plutarch could be appropriated for a democratic polity, but those two things don't mesh well with one another. Having said that, I mean, there is, say, the legislator in Rousseau's thinking. I mean, I wonder, you know, in the government of Poland, he takes up the, you know, Numa, et cetera. I mean, is this a, you know, Plutarchian element there? I mean, Rousseau's, of course, everyone knows, the sort of legislator, you know, persuades without, you know, convinces the people without persuading, and you know, there's no appeal to force. It's like a kind of a godlike figure. Is there a legislator Plutarch connection?
Oh, definitely, yes. And there's a whole, one thing I didn't touch on in the book, where this is the whole civil religion tradition as well, right? But even for Rousseau, and it is true that the legislator plays an important role, but it's a founding role, right? And once the legislator sets the basic law, they go away. And so if there is a moment of stewardship and deliberation in initially setting the boundaries, it no longer plays a role in the ongoing discussions. So, and therefore, I mean, Brousseau obviously maybe despairs that his model won't work because of the nature of modern politics, the influences of modern commerce and popular mores and so on. But, you know, it's not that I'm necessarily arguing for a strong aristocratic vision of politics, but perhaps a notion that some importance of attentiveness to moral development is important for democracies to sustain themselves. I mean, part of this book, a lot of this book was written between, you know, 2016 and 2020, when we were somewhat, I'm in Canada, obviously, but despairing of the nature of public life. And I think brought to me, anyway, reading a lot of these texts, that democracies will be in peril even more so if we don't pay a bit more attention to issues of not just the quality of leaders, but the quality of civility and moral development in the population as a whole. Again, with all the caveats of recognizing the virtues of pluralism and so on, but I don't think that that necessarily means you throw out the language of virtue completely.
Yeah. Well, that's great. That's a great place, I think, to stop. So thanks again, Rebecca, for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.